Morning Show with Greg Berg. Let's check WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, Brewers shut out by the Cubs up at Miller Park last night, 8-0. And the White Sox lost their home opener to Detroit, 9-7 in 10. Tonight, Brewers and Cubs again at Miller Park. White Sox are off. NBA, the Bucks lose to the Brooklyn Nets, 119-111. The Bulls were off. Tonight, the Bucks are off. The Bulls play in Boston. In the NHL, the Blackhawks off last night. They skated home tonight against St. Louis. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service on this Friday, April 6th. Mostly cloudy, windy, and cold. Today's high 35. Right now, wind from the west-northwest at 18. A little chilly out there. 34 degrees Racine, 33 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the Morning Show with Greg Berg, next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Today we encounter the great mind of Socrates through author Ron Gross and a really extraordinary book called Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost, published by Tarcher Putnam. This is a thought-provoking book in every sense of the word, and I cannot remember the last time I read a book that I found so profoundly thought-provoking. And we're going to be exploring with Ron Gross the figure of Socrates and his significance over 2,000 years after he lived, and the influence of some of his ideas, and these seven master keys, which Ron Gross believes should be a part of everyone's life. I should mention that Ron Gross chairs the university seminar on innovation at Columbia University, and he is responsible for several different books, one of which, appropriately enough, is called The Lifelong Learner. Ron Gross, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Greg.
Tell us a little bit about your own personal encounter with the figure of Socrates. Has your fascination with him been in place for a long time?
It certainly has, and he has done a great deal to show me how easy and how much fun it is to use my mind to the utmost and enable me to achieve some of my goals and enjoy my life more and improve my relationships. It actually started for me real early at the age of 9. I noticed one day that my father used to take a big book down from a top shelf of the bookshelf in our living room each day, and he'd tear out 3 or 4 pages of this very impressive-looking book, fold them neatly into threes, put them in his breast pocket, and leave for work. And then when he'd come back at night, he'd take the papers out of his pocket, flatten them out, put them back in the book. And when I finally had the chance to ask him what this was all about, he explained to me that in his work and in his life, he did not have the opportunity to meet the most brilliant, the wittiest, the most enjoyable, the wisest people of our time, but that he could spend an hour with those people each day on his way to and from work on the subway, and that's exactly what he did, and it changed his life, and by passing it along to me, it changed mine, because a couple of years after that, he took me to my first Broadway show, and it was a show called Barefoot in Athens, and it was about Socrates, and I saw my hero tramping around the agora in ancient Athens, that great marketplace at the foot of the Acropolis, and I was hooked. I didn't wear shoes for a week. And ever since then, he's been my hero, and he has become, as he was to his companions in 5th century Athens, a beloved friend, a wise counselor, a stern mentor, and one who has gotten me to perform things that I never thought I'd be able to do. And that's his great gift to us, I think, that he can do that for anyone, I believe. That was always his contention, and it's proven true in my life.
We should say that not only have you written very effectively about Socrates, you also enjoy taking to the streets of New York City dressed as Socrates, talking like Socrates, and encountering strangers and engaging them in interesting dialogue, question and answer, much the way we believe Socrates engaged the public of Athens. Tell us a little bit about how you began doing that and what you see as the benefit of celebrating Socrates in this unconventional way.
Sure, Greg. Well, some people sometimes say, are you channeling Socrates? And that's not it at all. What I'm really doing is doing what I hope to help readers of the book do, and that is to bring out the Socrates in me, because the Socratic spirit is there in all of us. It's that spirit that we had as kids when we weren't afraid to ask brash questions, when we were learning all the time, when we were constantly acquiring new skills and capabilities. And that's what I find I can do when I don the toga and the headband and take my great staff and come loping out of the 42nd Street and Broadway subway station, as I did 3 days ago in Manhattan, and start talking with people about topics like what is happiness or what makes a city great.
And people are receptive to that, by and large.
Oh, yes. They at first, of course, it gets a lot of attention, and people want to ask me some funny questions. But pretty soon, they realize that this is something that they really enjoy and benefit from. And we had a 45-minute conversation at the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway, and at the end of it, one of the people who happened to be passing by and got lured in was Bert Bauman, the past president of the New York State Trial Lawyers Association. And he said at the end of this conversation, Socrates, if you had been on the Enron board, you might have been able to save the soul of that company. So what Socrates has to say and what he wants us to think about are very, very relevant to our time. He really speaks to our situation in every way, particularly in this holiday season when we're being implored to buy. He has a very powerful message about what we really need in the way of gifts. And he also has things to say to us about what we're encountering with our war on terrorism, believe it or not. He lived through the same thing, so perhaps we can talk about those kinds of relevance that Socrates has to our lives today.
I want to ask you for just a very brief sense of how we know what we know about Socrates. What comes down to us 2,500 years later? I mean, in terms of the scope of his own writings or those around him that wrote about Socrates and what he believed. What exactly is the tangible legacy from which we can draw these life lessons?
That's a very revealing question, Greg, because it actually is a testament to Socrates' gift for friendship. Socrates never wrote anything. There's not a line, not a single sentence in any library in the world that it was written and signed by Socrates. And that's because he believed that we really only think our best thoughts, that what he called philosophy was really only done when you sat down with people, looked them in the eye, heard their voice, listened to them, answered to them, had real communion with them. And so he never wrote anything. Then therefore, we would know nothing about him if it weren't that his friends so revered and enjoyed and valued their time with him that they, Plato and Xenophon and a couple of others, spent the better part of their lives, both while Socrates was still alive and after his death, because they were much younger, in recording for us the conversation so that we can actually walk the streets of Athens with Socrates rather than reading what he thinks we should think. We can walk the streets of Athens with him, and that's what we do in the book, and hear him talking to his friends, go to parties with him, go to the theater with him, go to business places with him, and see exactly what he said to people and what impact that had on people. And so the works from which we know about Socrates are a gift to his gift for friendship. They're a testament to his gift for friendship. We wouldn't know a thing about him if it wasn't that he made such great friends that they were willing to take part of their lives to share him with us.
We're talking with Ron Gross, who is the author of Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost. Socrates, in his lifetime, was, of course, a figure of some controversy. Can you give us just a brief sense of why that was, or what it was, what was so provocative about his ideas that that made him so feared by some?
Of course, and he was indeed. He was dubbed the gadfly, and what they meant by that, his friends and neighbors, was that his constant questioning of the way they were living their lives and the way the state was being run reminded them of those insects that bite and bite the butts of farm animals in the summer and can drive an animal crazy if the animal can't swat them away with its tail. And Socrates' questions were seen as like the bites of the gadfly, that he was constantly accosting people with these questions. And, of course, he'd been doing that to some of the biggest horses' asses in Athens for decades. And then what happened was that Athens, like our country, got involved with a war with terrorists, the Spartans. And the city was demolished by terrorism. The citizens began to be suspicious of each other. They found that they wanted to give up some of their treasured freedoms in the name of security, and they began looking around for scapegoats. And the Socrates had begun to get on their nerves because even under this kind of pressure, he insisted on being a critical thinker, on thinking for himself, on challenging authority when necessary, on insisting that citizens like himself should know what was going on and have the right and the duty to help formulate the right policies. So some of the citizens brought him up on charges, atheism, corrupting the minds of the young with new ideas, and put him on trial for his life at the age of 70. And Socrates was condemned by that court and could have easily escaped, but he decided that it was the best thing for him to do was to actually accept the verdict and take the hemlock. And in doing that, he launched our great tradition of civil disobedience, so that some of our heroes of our day, like Martin Luther King and Nelson Mandela, invoked Socrates from their jail cells when they followed in the path that he laid out of contesting an unjust law by accepting the penalty of the state.
I want to probe into the seven master keys, which you say in the title of your book, are the keys to using your mind to the utmost.
Wonderful.
First of all, exactly where did these seven come from? I mean, these are not a master list of Socrates. Have you yourself drawn out what you find to be seven predominant themes or principles?
Exactly, but they are right there. They are the principles that drove Socrates in his lifelong quest for wisdom and right action. In fact, each chapter of the book starts with bringing you right into the presence of Socrates and walking around with him while he exemplifies whichever of the seven principles we're talking about: know thyself, ask great questions, grow with your friends, challenge authority. We see him doing that, stand next to him as he's doing it, and see exactly how he did it with his friends and neighbors in 5th century Athens. Then in each chapter, I show how someone in our time has done exactly the same thing using Socrates' methods and showing how his methods are just as applicable today as they were in his time.
Even if not given credit at the time.
Precisely. And then the rest of the chapter, of each chapter, are dozens of exercises by which you can easily and enjoyably master one of these techniques for yourself so that you can begin to bring forth that Socratic spirit in you.
I have to say that one of the things that I found most striking about this list and about the principles was that I could imagine all kinds of marvelous applications to people of all ages. I could imagine somebody who is 75 years old, and I could imagine someone 15 years old, and anybody in between finding food for thought in these principles.
Oh, Greg, I'm so glad that occurred to you, that's certainly what I hope would be the case, because these were indeed principles which Socrates applied throughout his life, and I truly believe that they are equally applicable to the youngest child and to a person of advanced years who wants to reinvigorate their life.
I mean, I think, for instance, a principle like think for yourself. I mean, what more important lesson is there for a 10-year-old in this world in which we live, full of temptations and wrong paths. I mean, that's an important principle, as are many of them.
Exactly right. And let's just take that one for a moment. This is a great season in which to apply Think for Yourself, because this is a season, the holiday season, in which there is great joy in the world, but there's a lot of pressure on each of us to accept the way we're supposed to think and feel. That is, we're being told by the media and by a lot of people around us that we have to have certain feelings, that we have to be joyous in certain ways, that we shouldn't ask certain questions that are not considered appropriate. So it's a great season in which to ask yourself, well, what of this do I really believe? What really makes sense to me? What are my values as they relate to this kind of holiday season? It's a great time to do that, both in terms of gift giving, what kind of gifts will really express my spirit and really honor what I want to honor in the people that I'm gifting. It's a great time to try to strenuously to think for ourselves. And by doing so, I think we can make the holidays even more rewarding.
I want to ask you about two other principles that seem to me very close to that one. Think for yourself. Maybe one is a great tool towards that end, and the other almost seems like the same thing. So I'm really anxious to know what you see as the distinction. Let's start with that, which is principle number four, which is not only should we think for ourselves, but we should also challenge convention.
Right.
Now, what are you saying there specifically that goes beyond think for yourself?
Well, basically, in challenge convention, I'm looking to encourage people to examine the whole framework they've been given by their parents, by their schooling, by the profession that they were trained in or the occupation that they were trained in, all of those conventional ways of thinking and feeling that were handed down to us. It is close to think for yourself, but there are different techniques that you can use in achieving each of them. In the case of challenging convention, I evoke the wonderful image that Socrates presented of the cave. You may recall this from school or college acquaintance with 5th century Athens. Socrates evoked the idea of a race of people who lived in an underground cave where they never saw things in the real light of day, but just shadows on the back wall of the cave. And then one of them is liberated one day and gets a chance to go upstairs to our world and see what things look like in real sunlight and what real objects and people look like. And it's very powerful in terms of helping us free ourselves from the dominance of those flickering shadows that we spend so much of our time with on the television screen or the movie screen, and to urge us to come into contact with things as they really are and challenge the whole notion of whether we are in touch with reality. And I think post 9/11, we have realized that that's true of our relation to the whole world, to the great world out there, that we knew far little, too little about how people regarded us and what the possible perils and dangers were of living in the world of the 21st century. So challenge convention is really having the courage to contest that which so many people around us believe. Think for yourself teaches people specific concrete tools to use to make their minds work to the utmost. And so I teach you seven keys to that you can run through when you're dealing with any problem or challenge in order to come up with an optimal solution.
I also love among your principles, and this is also one I think closely related, you say we need to ask great questions. First of all, explain for us what you see as the distinction between great questions and questions that are not so great.
Sure, Greg.
I need to know that for my line of work, you see.
Well, I was going to say that that you are obviously a master of asking great questions, and you just exemplified it in the way you asked this question. That is, the not-so-good questions are the questions that can just be answered yes or no or by giving a few facts. The great questions are questions that open up the other person to reveal some things about themselves and about the issue under discussion that you never would have learned in any other way. And so by asking by telling a person that what they've said is really interesting and you'd love to hear more about it, and then asking a pointed question about that will bring them forth can be extremely illuminating, and by the way, will get you a reputation for being a terrific conversationalist. So the kind of great questions that I teach in the book are questions like, for example, in your workplace, in the place that you spend your work life, asking questions like, what really gets rewarded around here? And then spending a week nosing around to clarify your sense of what it is that people really get rewarded for doing. And this has had a profound effect on people who've done it in terms of both advancing in their own organization or realizing that the organization they're in is not the one that's consistent with their values and finding one that is. Or in an intimate relationship, asking yourself, what is it like for to be in this relationship with me? What is it like for the other person to be in this relationship with me? And asking that question, not of the other person, but of yourself.
I hadn't even thought about that, or I guess I'd forgotten that distinction that that great questions can be posed to oneself and not just to others.
Yes, indeed. That's a wonderful point. Indeed, exactly right. Some of the best questions are ones that are posed to oneself. And Socrates himself found his vocation in life. He was told by the oracle at Delphi, the greatest authority in his world, that he was the wisest man that existed. And he knew that was ridiculous because he always contended that he was only an ignorant man seeking to get wiser by working together with others. And so he actually disproved the oracle's dictum by going around Athens trying to find a man wiser than himself. And when it turned out that nobody really was as wise as they thought they were, Socrates realized that what the oracle meant was that because he was aware of his own ignorance and of how much he had to learn, there was no one wiser than that. So Socrates himself questioned things that he was told about himself and insisted on answering by thinking for himself.
That really brings to mind principle number one, and I'm assuming these are not in order of importance, but I should have asked you before we plunged in.
No, you can start anywhere.
Okay.
And so any one of these that that appeals to listeners. And by the way, I just want to mention that these are all available together with exercises on doing them on a website in which we present free much that's in the book, just as Socrates never took pay for his teaching, but presented, offered it at no price. On the website, www.socratesway.com, listeners can see Socrates in action in New York with New Yorkers and see what that's like and also learn how to use some of these techniques themselves.
What you were just talking about really brings to mind the first of the principles in terms of posing good questions to ourselves. Principle number one of these seven master keys is to know thyself. What is the essential importance of that, or in what way do we tend not to know ourselves?
Well, it's very well exemplified by that movie that's just out, Tuesdays with Maury, based on the wonderful book by Mitch Albom, the very successful sports writer who
Right.
returned in midlife to visit his old teacher, Maury Schwartz, who was dying. And Maury, in a series of sessions on Tuesday afternoons, made Mitch Albom realize that he had gotten completely out of touch with himself, that he didn't really know himself. Schwartz played the Socrates to Albom's seemingly successful life and revealed to this still fairly young man that he had a long way to go before he was really at peace with himself and was doing what he was really born to do. And that so exemplifies the fact that Socrates' method is applicable in our time, because that's exactly what Socrates did with the young men of Athens of his day, and why he was brought up on charges of corrupting their minds, because he would question them in ways that made them challenge whether what they'd been told was what they should do with their lives really made sense to them. So it's a good illustration of that movie is a wonderful drama of this process that we should all put ourselves through.
I've been thinking about that. I mean, I think nowadays we are pretty well acquainted with that idea of knowing yourself, of pondering, you know, what you like, what you dislike, what is important to you and whatever. But I imagine 2,500 years ago, this was a rather provocative idea.
Indeed it was, because people were, I think, very much into following in their parents' footsteps. If your father was a potter, it was pretty well ordained that you would be a potter. But I think we have problems that are no less grave in that regard. That is, while we may feel free to depart from the roles that our parents played, we're still completely brainwashed by the media and the entertainment that we watch as to what a good life is like. And so I think probably it's just as difficult and just as necessary for us to ask ourselves important questions like this to find out what we truly believe that it was as it was for the 5th century Athenians.
We are talking with Ron Gross, who is the author of Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost, published by Tarcher Putnam. We've talked about the first four of this list of seven. Know thyself, ask great questions, think for yourself, challenge convention. The fifth on the list, I think, is the most surprising and the one that is maybe makes the least sense just on the surface. I mean, some of these others are rather self-explanatory, although they're worth exploring in rich detail. But number five is grow with friends. Grow with friends. What do you mean by that?
Well, that's actually one that Americans have perhaps done more with recently than any of the others. What I mean by that is that Socrates, as we said at the start, realized that it was only with other lively-minded people who cared about the same things that he cared about that he could nurture his own soul and bring his own mind to its peak. And so he is famous, of course, for going around sponsoring dialogues with people, just talking with them about things that really matter in ways that were not solemn but actually exhilarating. And we Americans have tended to let our institutions atrophy that helped us do that, so that there are very few occasions when we have a chance to come together with our friends and neighbors and colleagues to talk about the things that really matter. We tend to be cocooned away with our own TV set and dial and on our couches. What's happening now is that Americans all around the country are coming out of their homes and going to what they call Socrates cafes. There are hundreds of them around the country, and on the website, listeners can find ways to find their own in Milwaukee or launch their own, which is even more fun. And these are just opportunities for people to come together every week or every 2 weeks to talk about these kinds of issues that really matter to them, not just the immediate politics of the day, but things that are a little deeper than that, but which they can explore together in very fruitful and enjoyable ways. In fact, there's one that meets in the atrium of an office building in the middle of Manhattan every Tuesday evening at 6:30, the Sony Atrium, and Socrates himself occasionally turns up there. New Yorkers just wander in there off the street, pull together some of the metal cafe tables that are strewn around the lobby, and form a circle and start talking about issues like what is happiness or what makes a city great. So if listeners want to find or start something like that in Milwaukee, they can find directions for doing that on the website.
One of the things I like about the way you phrase that, I mean, it's just three relatively simple words, but the idea that friendship and our friends are a means of growth for us. And I don't think we tend to think of our friends in that way, although it is certainly true.
Well, it is indeed, and what I do in that chapter is show you how to look at your present circle of friends to see whether it really is helping you to grow and being as enjoyable as you would like. I also show how you can turn any conversation at one of perhaps the next Christmas party you're going to go to into a much more interesting dialogue than anyone expected, and have everyone enjoy it a great deal, because Socrates was the master of doing that. So there are all kinds of simple ways that we can turn almost all our social encounters into much more rewarding and enjoyable occasions than they presently are. You know, our great American philosopher Thoreau said once that we descend to meet, that when we come together, we tend to fall to the lowest common denominator and talk about the weather or the parking, but that there are ways that we can contrive to rise when we meet, to actually engage each other on a slightly higher level than we usually do. And that's what we teach in these very simple techniques in that chapter.
Of course, Socrates is as well known as anything for what you call Master Key number 6, speak the truth.
Right. And do we need that these days? As Bert Bauman, that trial lawyer, said to Socrates on 42nd Street the other day, We have seen our greatest economy in the world brought to the brink of ruin by widespread lies and deceptions in high places. And so it's obvious that we need to reacquire the virtue of speaking the truth, that this is not just some ideal, but a practical necessity if we're to get our economy and our capital markets working again and earning the confidence of investors and consumers. It's absolutely essential that we reinstall the kind of truth-speaking that Socrates stood for as a prime value of our society.
And what's intriguing to me is that there is value in speaking truth. I mean, if you're the president of Enron, or if you're just dealing with your spouse or your children or your teacher or your neighbor. I mean, it's something that really finds meaning in even the humblest, most ordinary corners of life.
Oh, it certainly does. And when I in that chapter, when I come to share a story of someone in our time who does what Socrates did, I choose a doctor in Kaiser Permanente in Denver, who a surgeon who made a crucial mistake that didn't have dire consequences in an operation. He picked up the wrong vial to administer to a patient in the aftermath of an operation. And the next day, his name is Michael Leonard, in the next day he came in and gathered his fellow surgeons who performed the same operation and said, yesterday I made a major mistake and I just wanted to let you know about it because it's very easy to do and we really should do something to prevent it from happening again. And he told them about this mistake that he'd made where he picked up the wrong vial of the two vials that he was supposed to administer. And all five of the other surgeons said, oh, well, we've done that. Each of them said, I've done that, but none of them had ever told the others because even though they hadn't had dire results, they were embarrassed and they just felt, well, since nothing bad happened, we'll just let that one go. Of course, once he did share this mistake, they were very easily able to remark these vials, to relabel them so that that mistake could never happen again. And that procedure is called the near-miss procedure. That is, encouraging people to report mistakes and near misses that could have been costly or damaging before they get that way, is now installed in hospitals all around the country. So it's another example of how one of these ideals that we tend to think might just be a high value of an ancient time is actually one of the most practical things we can do to prevent disease, infection, and death in our hospitals.
I suppose it fosters our ability to learn about all kinds of things, too.
Indeed, absolutely. It's what gives legitimacy to whistleblowers and all kinds of people who we desperately need to keep us informed about what's really going on that the powers that be might not want us to know.
Explain your seventh and final master key, strengthen your soul.
Well, that was Socrates' basic call. Basically, what he said to his fellow Athenians and what this book says to us is, stop being so completely preoccupied with earning a living, with making the most money that you possibly can, with acquiring goods and possessions, even with becoming renowned in your field. And look into yourself a bit and ask yourself whether you are really taking care of your soul, whether you are nurturing what is absolutely unique about yourself, so that you are getting the kind of joy and gratification out of life that can only come when you are living in consistently with your true values and what really is meaningful for you. So in that last chapter, I talk about things like finding the soul in your work, finding the real meaning of the work that you do every day, day in, day out, so that you can accentuate the parts of it that mean something to you and enjoy them more and thereby make a greater contribution and be more successful, or how to see yourself going through stages of self-discovery in your life. These are things that you can be doing every day as part of your everyday life, not just on Sunday when you might go to religious observances or Saturday, but things that we can do every day in getting ourselves keyed into our own inner spirit.
That ties into what will turn out to be our last question, I think. The fact I wanted to ask you about this, the fact that what you have laid out here in these principles important to Socrates can actually be woven into many different approaches to life. For instance, if someone had a fervent religious faith. There is nothing, in your view, I think, essentially contradictory about this list. I mean, it is possible to adhere to these seven principles and at the same time be a devout Jew or Muslim or Christian or whatever your religion might be, for instance.
I do believe that's true, and indeed the church, the early church fathers and devout Christians throughout our tradition have looked to Socrates and seen him as a precursor of Jesus, that is, as the noblest of the pagans, and one who, in his integrity and in his dedication to the truth and in his insistence that we nurture our soul, was actually following a truly virtuous life even before the coming of Jesus. So he was revered by outstanding religious people in every generation as a person of tremendous virtue.
The book is Socrates' Way, Seven Master Keys to Using Your Mind to the Utmost, published by Tarcher Putnam. And Ron Gross, what an extraordinary book this is, and what a thought-provoking conversation this has been. I'm so grateful for your time and glad that we had this opportunity to talk.
Thank you, Greg. I enjoyed it tremendously. Have a wonderful holiday.
Thank you. And the time is 8:46. That interview was out of the morning show archives from about 15 years ago. And for part two of today's program, I want to replay for you a portion of my conversation recorded a week ago with a faculty colleague from the music department at Carthage College, Dr. Wael Farouk, head of the piano program there, and about to undertake what really amounts to a once-in-a-lifetime concert for any of us who will be privileged to be there tonight. A concert, 7 o'clock at Siebert Chapel, that will feature all five piano concertos of Ludwig van Beethoven. It is a nearly unprecedented sort of accomplishment, and in our conversation, I asked Dr. Farouk to explain whether or not, in fact, anybody else, to his knowledge, has attempted to play all five Beethoven piano concertos in the course of a single evening.
To my knowledge, I know that Daniel Barenboim did that, I believe, once in Berlin several years ago. And while the New Philharmonic were researching for publicity's sake how if it's been done before, it actually happened once in California, I think around 2005. But since then, it's the first time to happen in the Midwest, and I think based on their research, first time worldwide to happen three nights in a row.
Right. So, to not just do it once with right. each of it itself is right. kind of an amazing thing, but right. but on consecutive nights to do it again and again and again. We should say that when somebody plays a concerto on a typical orchestra concert, mm-hmm. for instance, maybe one of the Beethoven piano concertos, it would be one work on a program that would also typically include maybe a symphony and an overture or something, sure. But it would be just the one piece. Sometimes maybe two, but certainly it's not typical to fill an evening with concertos. Particularly accompanied by orchestra and so on. So in terms of just what you are playing, it feels like it would be a blistering sort of physical marathon on top of just sort of artistically what you are accomplishing as well. Talk for a moment about the sort of gauntlet that this represents and how you are preparing for it.
Of course, I can answer you better after it's done and see really how it how it feels and how it felt and if I'm still alive, hopefully afterwards. But I think what I'm really proud of, first of all, that I feel very blessed and fortunate to have asked to be a part of this major. Not just a musical experience, but really cultural experience and human experience. I don't think there is a more human composer who felt and suffered as much as Beethoven did. And, of course, this is part of his greatness and his eternal flame, if you will, that really comes in his music, most of all the concertos and the piano sonatas, of course. I also feel very proud that doing it at Carthage first, along the reasons doing something like the Brahms Cycle, that we are really inviting our audience to come and to be part of the Carthage community and the Carthage life, but also to start supporting our students when they perform and then when they lecture or do their amazing work. However, on a more personal note to answer your question, I don't think I'm doing anything differently to prepare for these concerts. I know that the challenge will be the physical stamina. Even more, I believe, will be the mental stamina, just to focus and to sustain the intensity that focus that requires to play more than one concerto. And they are not truffles, as you know, but they also have that immense emotional requirement in them. As you know, he was a brilliant, brilliant pianist, but because of his hearing that started alarmingly disappearing in his mid-20s, I feel like every concerto is really a station or a stop, and it shows you from a different angle, where is Beethoven now and what is he doing pianistically, musically, artistically, but also on the personal side, what he's going through, something like the fourth piano concerto, which was his the last concert he ever played in public. He was the soloist himself in the fourth piano concerto, and it was a monumental concert. I mean, if we look at programs today, this man played the fourth piano concerto. He premiered the fifth symphony, the sixth symphony in the same concert, the Choral Fantasy. And
which also involves piano,
right? Yeah. And a choir, and but all of that in the same evening. That was his farewell concert to Vienna, if you will. And of course, a couple of years before that, he attempted suicide or considered it, and then he wrote his famous Heiligenstadt testimony, which is a letter to his brother, saying, "Well, I am really contemplating, you know, taking my life, but my love to my art and my love to God and my love to my fellow humans is what is preventing me, because I feel I have more to contribute." So just reading that, just knowing that, that he's going through this enormous pain and enormous loneliness, but he's still writing masterpieces to us.
Wow. Let me play just a moment of the middle movement of this fourth piano concerto that you just mentioned, written at this very poignant moment, actually, in Beethoven's life. This happens to be Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. This is just a little bit of that piano concerto, number 4 of Beethoven. Utter beauty and such simplicity. And as one listens very closely, you can hear the humming of Glenn Gould. He was famous for humming along to his playing this just brief moment from the fourth piano concerto of Beethoven. You mentioned, Dr. Farouk, that when we listen to these five concertos, we can have a sense of where Beethoven is in his life. When we listen to the nine symphonies, we get a real sense of his development from the first couple symphonies, which are very classical in nature, and then the symphonies, at least for the most part, gradually become longer and darker and more dramatic and more romantic in character. And so we're also tracing, in a sense, the evolution of music itself from the classical to the romantic period. Is there a similar arc in these five concertos, or do they not represent, in terms of time, quite the same span and not quite the same movement from classical to romantic?
No, absolutely. I believe they really monitor his growth as pianist and his growth as a composer, because Beethoven had tremendous impact in the development of pianistic evolutions, and we're actually talking about him right now in piano literature, and we're going through the sonatas, and you can see how much he's doing in forms and in pianistic patterns that really inspired Liszt, Chopin, and Czerny, of course, and everyone who came after him. As you know, the first concerto, or the opus number assigned to the first concerto, is really the second concerto. He wrote the second concerto first, but he chose to have it published as number two. Number three is the only one in the minor key, the C minor, Beethoven's key. And number four is G major. Number five is well known as the Emperor. Of course, Beethoven didn't give it that title. It was actually a French officer after hearing, during hearing Czerny's premiere, and he thought that, you know, the Emperor must be passing, and which, ironic, at the time, the Emperor, of course, was Napoleon, you know, and Beethoven had a round or two with him. But, for instance, what he does with the slow movements, particularly in those concertos, is very significant and very revolutionary in many ways. So we have the orchestration, we have the harmonic, and again, the pianistic patterns that he uses in those slow movements. We have the piano starting the first movement of the fourth concerto. That was really unprecedented. It's always the orchestra, as you know, playing the exposition. Mozart did that a couple times, but only in the second or the third movements of a concerto, but never before that the piano really opens the entire concerto. Then connecting the second and third movements, like in the fourth concerto that he just played excerpts. And then, of course, the fifth piano concerto is on a massive romantic scale of just declaration of triumph, I would want to say. Of course, he chooses that heroic key of E-flat, where he also wrote the Eroica Symphony, but also the cascading opening of those passages in the piano and the grandeur, and contrasting that with the intimate second movement, and then again connecting the second movement to the third. There are no pauses, no interruption, and it's once again a declaration of triumph over fate, over pain, over loss of hearing, etc., etc.
I want to play just a few moments from this fifth and final concerto, which again is known as The Emperor, and with good reason. The magnificent music of Ludwig van Beethoven is going to be played tonight at Siebert Chapel in a once-in-a-lifetime concert that will begin at 7 o'clock. Dr. Wael Farouk with the New Philharmonic Orchestra playing all five piano concertos of Beethoven. Tickets will be available for purchase at the door, but you might want to go to carthage.edu/tickets to get ticket information and perhaps purchase your tickets ahead of time. The concert again begins tonight at 7 o'clock. My thanks to Dr. Wael Farouk for joining me today on the morning show to talk about what promises to be a most memorable evening of music. Monday on the morning show, I will be speaking with a Holocaust survivor in anticipation of Holocaust Remembrance Day.